I know. I'm direct. I want to.
We have another part of an answer here.
My answer to your question. I know that rapping has helped me a lot in school. I attend the High School for International Affairs, and rapping, what I've done with my skills of rapping is that when it comes to a test and studying, I like put together words, rhyme them together, and then I make a rap out of my tests or my studies. And Smurf wants me to tell you about a rap that she helped me with my world history test. It's called International Travels, and what we had to do was learn how to spell all the words and learn all the countries. And what we did was we did a rap called International Travels, and I'm not gonna do it now. You can hear it later, but it's helped me a lot in school.
Part three of the answer: the only study that I know of to date that is an academic study of rapping was done by a group of linguists working in Philadelphia on an education project. And it was actually a literacy project where they were working with teachers who were just literally writing off a lot of the students as people who had no literary skills or no skills which were useful. And yet these same students, many of them were just incredible rappers. So the project was developed around rapping and used rapping as the vehicle to look at what skills are prevalent in the African American community and how that can be used to the good of the students. So that's a federal survey too. It's not been published yet, but apparently it will be published by the federal government in the whatever Department of Education, I guess, papers. Part two of the question, and that'll close it out.
Sure.
Calypso, reggae, rhythm, and blues.
Do that rap?
No.
Right, calypso, reggae, rhythm, and blues. That's taking all the different art forms and putting them together. So, you know, like, that's in a lot of the raps. That's in a lot. Do it?
You know it, yeah.
He said do it.
What, the blues, soul, reggae, rhythm, and blues? Masterpiece, rhythm, and blues.
Trying to figure it out.
Okay.
Up here.
This is a song done by, who was it? It's a Soul Sonic Force. The Soul Sonic Force, they used to go calypso, reggae, rhythm and blues, master mix those number one tunes, play those favorite songs of mine and accept my calls on a request line. A DJ will play just for you, cause you gotta get down to show one knows how to. And then another one that I do that has all the art forms in it is: the music is pumping sounds, it's got the floor shaking, the ability to move, it's got the able body breaking, moving faster and faster. And somehow it seems as though we're fantasizing or living a dream. Pop blockers, punk rockers clamor onto the floor, the MCs are rocking rhythms with rhymes galore. And for all of those out there who appreciate rapping, be prepared to kick it live, cause we're fresh and snapping. Windmills, backhands, spinning on your knees, the DJs are spinning beats and tunes to please. The feeling feels good and your adrenaline is risen. The graffiti walls has blurred your vision. Listen up in the dark, homeboys are making art. The MCs out there trying to get up on the chart. Billboard, Black Stars are all magazines. And the record sales are booming, selling to the teens. The evolution of music in the whole has changed. Everything is so different, synthesized, and strange. But the beat is so unique down on the street. The feelings are the same no matter who you meet, cause the young and the old, they never pause to say that they wouldn't mind rapping to be a DJ. The talents are buried deep within our souls, and we wish to be raised from this hellhole. Cause money is hard in the government, and the poor is watching their every cent. While they sit sad and sob, had to share and divide, and they're always praying, giving praises to God.
Created by MC Caesar.
I think the link between the forms, the calypso, the toasting in certain areas of the West Indies, the message rap, all of this really can be traced back to an African tradition of making social commentary in song. certainly when you listen to African songs, especially the older traditional pieces, you find that song was perhaps the major vehicle for making commentary. You could say things in song about your society, about your tribal group, that you could never say outright. Song was always that sort of vehicle. In this country, in the African-American community, song has long served the same purpose. Perhaps the clearest example of this in the 1800s and the early 1900s was the entire African-American work song tradition, where blacks would sing to set a tempo and to ease the tedium of group work. Let's say there might be 50 persons hoeing in a field or shucking oysters or working in a tobacco factory. If you listen to the words of these songs, and this is the recording of them, is one of the great contributions of the Library of Congress, who sent field workers into the southern states in the 1930s to record work songs. When you listen to them, you realize there is a long tradition of protest there, of social commentary, which was the songs were being sung in front of the, years and years ago, in front of the white slave owners. In this decade, they were being sung in front of the white captains and foremen and bosses on the work gangs. As long as you were working, you could say these things in song. Well, this same use of music as a vehicle for social commentary has carried right through. In the Caribbean, it has taken the form of calypso. It has taken the form of toasting. In this country, most recently, it's taken the form of rapping. With that, we're going to have to move on to our next workshop, so I'd like to thank you all for being a great audience and ask for a hand for the International Playgirls and the Punk Funk Nation.
Thank you.
You'll be able to see them both performing on the main stage. That's the large blue and white tent there at 4:15 approximately today, where Grandmaster Nell will kick off. We'll have both groups performing raps, and then they'll be joined by the Scanner Boys of Philadelphia. Black expressive culture in Philadelphia area, a group better known in Philadelphia as the Disco Queens and Kings. The Disco Queens and Kings have been dancing on the streets of Philadelphia for a number of years. They're well known to Philadelphians as probably the city's premier GQ dancers. What we're going to do here is talk to them about GQ dancing. We're going to demonstrate a few of the moves that went into it and discuss the evolution of this form. It's a family group, so maybe I should let one of the members of the family begin to tell us who's in the group now and how large the group is at its fullest. Richie, this is Richie Guilford here.
Ooh.
Richie, you're on. That's right. Could you take
Sorry
the mic
about that.
And introduce the members of the group to us?
How y'all doing today? That's good. This Pineapple Guilford, show him a little tune. This Desiree Thomas right here, my little sister. Ellison as Hakeem Love, the manager of our group. This Paul, a break dancer, Paul Allen. Could we get a hand? My name is Richie Rich. Not the cartoon, but the one in front of you, Richie Rich. Thank you. We all related, but except Paul. He a friend we met off the streets of the ghetto. But he just like family because he been with us over now 3 years, 3 to 4 years. I like to say we started downtown, but we started off from my cousin. He died 1983 on a moped. He taught us when I was 5, my brother was 6. They wasn't even in the group then. It was me and him with my oldest cousin. He 22 now, but he did in his grave. That's how I started from my oldest cousin, Russell Guilford. But we all Guilfords, and one time it's right here, my little sister.
How was it that you got started with the group?
I was great coming to that. To be truthful, we live right down the street from this little playground. We used to always go inside the playground. My cousin bring us in there. We ain't really know how to dance at all, but he started picking up. He used to watch people on the streets, like, you know, people that drink wine, be on the corner singing songs. It was one step called the cha-cha. I'm going to show that to y'all real quick. This is how we learned. We learned from the cha-cha, five steps. That's one of the steps. That's how we learned. We started from cha-cha. Five steps up, five steps back. Then we got the half cha-cha. He gonna show you that one real quick. It's still the same, but it's half.
Count it off, Richie.
One, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. Same thing, but it's halfway.
So when you started off then, you talked about this playground, but you didn't quite explain what you were doing in the playground and how you ended up on the street.
We started playing on. My mom got a little upset. We went in the house one time. We was always good at musicians because my uncles and them play drums and lead guitar. We went and took my mom pots and pans, brand new pots and pans out the house, took them around the playground and started banging on them as drums because we didn't have none at the time. Then from there, we was dancing, flipping on bars, gymnastic. Then from there, we started going downtown because we seen this man downtown jiggling fire, juggling it up in the air, putting it out in his mouth. And I was still young. I was at the age of six then. So my cousin went down there. He used to work down there on one of them corner stands. He went down there and seen the man doing it right up under City Hall in Philadelphia, downtown. Then he next day, when he came home, he took us down there. We only had, like I said, one drum, just one drum. And the first time we ever danced downtown in Center City on the corners, we made $275. That's how many people love to see the dancing we do. And it's called GQ Dancing's, Guilford's Quality, GQ. That's the real name for it.
Now, the tradition of GQ dancing, at least in the family here, originated with the social dance of the cha-cha. He gave an example of two forms of the cha-cha, a simple five-step forward, five-step back dance that was a dance done in social settings. It wasn't originally intended as a performance dance. And when they first saw it, when they first saw the cha-cha performed, it was where?
Like I was saying, it was on the corners. These people my mom knew, they used to always come over the house. It was just some people that my mom's socials, give socials over at the house. The people, they was real good. I'm talking about real good. The cha-cha we do, they do a lot better, but it's always was five steps in the cha-cha. So we learned that from them, and then it went on. My cousin Russell started teaching us stuff like the sky whip. Show him that real quick, Al. The sky whip is something real dangerous because it's spinning up in the air.
Let's have a hand for Allison here. Now Richie, hold on. What we find with the development of GQ dancing, let me say a few words about GQ maybe before we go into some more specific steps. GQ dancing defines a broader form which was really reached its peak of popularity, at least in Philadelphia in the black community, before popping developed. Now, some of you have seen popping if you've watched, for example, the Scanner Boys, see the moves that they do. The popping was the form that immediately preceded breakdancing and is concurrent with breakdancing, in fact, a part of breakdancing. Everything that isn't a spin, really, in breakdancing can be defined as popping. Immediately before the popularity of popping in the black community, however, the form of GQ was real popular, and GQ emphasized stepping motions. Rather than body glides, rather than robot movements, the emphasis was on the fancy footwork, and that is continuing clearly an old, old tradition within the black community, a tradition easily dating back to the 1800s when you had the development of the solo male dance form at that time called buck dancing. Buck dancing was a rural dance form. In later years, out of buck dancing, you had the development on the stage of tap dancing. Alongside tap and buck, there were other forms of soft shoe, other forms of stepping traditions within the black community. Some of them you see with girls' drill teams. Others you see with fraternity groups who do their college stepping, such as the Groovefy Grooves, who we have here with us at the festival this year. GQ, as a popular dance form, evolved largely in the 1970s. and really, at least in Philadelphia, swept the area. This was the main performance dance. With the Disco Queens and Kings, it started off with a social dance base, that of the cha-cha. Then you started to add things that were acrobatic moves, moves drawn from a broader repertoire of black dance movements, such as the sky whip, a floor move. There were dance moves also drawn from other traditions as well, such that you put together all these different traditions onto the base, which was the cha-cha. Now, one of the other moves which they added was, interestingly enough, a move from Russian dancing. Richie, could you explain how in the world you got the Russian in your movement repertoire?
Yeah, like, we were still downtown going down in the summertime. Like, every day when it don't rain, we always went down. So we seen this Russian man. He told us he was from Russian. We wasn't sure, though. But he showed us this dance called the Russian. We like to show y'all this, too, because this is a hard dance. What you do?
That's the one-handed Russian.
And the no hands. Hands. That's called the Russian.
So there what we have right away, we're beginning to see three strands. We've got the social dance. We have a little bit of acrobatics with a sky whip. We've got some ethnic dance. There are a lot of other forms. One of the major one is probably gymnastics. Have you all done any training in gymnastics, and how did that become part of the dance movements that you do?
Really, from watching people. We never learned from nobody but my cousin, to be truthful, and the people that taught us the cha-cha. That was only two people we ever learned from. Everything else we made up on our own and learned on our own. Like tumbling, show them the backhand walk over real quick. The back walk over. This is something we learned on our own. The back walk over.
So simple.
Real simple. Another thing I like to show you, this called the hand flip. My two little cousins gonna show you. We made this up ourselves too, and a lot of people around the world copied this as they seen us doing this. And we got one more thing. It's called the foot pull up. We're gonna show you that one too. We made all this up ourselves, the foot pull up. This was before popping or anything ever got created out here. Yeah.
Now, it's important to emphasize that what we're doing here on the stage is breaking down the dance moves. Things that look acrobatic here but may look slow, when you put them in the context of a larger sequence of dance moves and you set them to the rhythm of the drum, which the Disco Queens and Kings play with them at all times when they're performing, they take on a whole new sense. It's always putting the moves in sequence that gives them their real special nature. Now, there are some other acrobatic moves that you all do. One of them is, I think you call it the donkey kick.
Yeah, I can show you that by myself. The donkey kick roll over.
What's most amazing is that they're able to do that on this raggedy stage here.
Yeah, this is a little raggedy stage, but it's still all right. Because we used to dancing on a block from here to this line anyway. We could dance on stuff small like that anyway.
Now, there are a number of other moves that they've taken in. What we've talked about so far then are now four dance traditions. Talked about ethnic dance, social dance. Talked about acrobatics and gymnastics.
And we
go ahead.
We got another one, too. We got so many of them. We'd be up here all day if we try to show y'all everything. But it's called the floor tap. Show them that one, fine. Desiree. The floor tap. They don't even.
Now, in terms of acrobatics, in terms of flash, you must recognize that if you're a street dancer, if you're out there dancing for money, dancing for tips, you want to do something more than just standard forms of dancing. You want to try for something unusual, so you develop your flash, you develop your own individual tricks. When you speak with dancers such as LaVon Robinson, the tap dancer, he'll tell you that when he was growing up in Philadelphia in the 1930s, tap dancing was then the predominant street form. Yet, tap dancers were a dime a dozen. Everybody on every block knew how to tap dance. All the kids were out on the street doing it. So, in order to get a job, if you really wanted to go beyond the street, you had to come up with something unique, something flashy. What developed out of that was the tradition of flash tap dancing, where suddenly you had the incorporation of some rather remarkable acrobatic moves within the tap repertoire. Well, this whole drive towards flash is also found in contemporary street performance. With the Disco Queens and Kings, perhaps one of the most impressive moves that is a pure flash move, something there to gather the crowd and to make everyone's jaws drop, is the stick jump, or what started as the stick jump. Ellison, could you tell us how that started and where you plan, where you've taken it and where you plan to take it?
Okay. I started jumping over a stick about 4 years ago. A long stick. Then I broke it down, and it just got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Now I can jump over a keychain with a key on it. And soon I'll be able to jump over a cigarette butt. I'm still working on it. But here's a routine.
It's really hard, y'all. Don't let your kids never try this. Okay. Don't let your little kids try that. They might flip over. Jumping over it. Over it. Never took his hands off. Over.
Show them what you're jumping over there, Allison. Hold that up.
Keychain with a key on it. Next we got for y'all something real popular we discovered a year ago. It's called Spinning on the Head. Show them one time, Paul.
Do you really want to do that on this floor?
Yeah, he can do it because we practice on it. It's to be done here. We pros. Spinning on the head. Give him a real big hand. We got to hear y'all for this one. Thank you very much. Yeah.
The key to street dancing is that you can borrow from any tradition as long as you can make it fit in your dance sequences. Now, the head spin is clearly a move from breakdancing. Paul here is a breakdancer. That's his specialty with the Disco Queens and Kings. In a group like this, everyone can have their own specialty that makes the group only that much more exciting when they're on the stage, or more specifically when they're on the street. Because as long as you can keep changing styles, as long as you can flip from one form to another, you keep the audience interested and you keep those nickels, dimes, dollar bills, $5 bills, hopefully, coming into the hat. The last form, which I'd like to have the group demonstrate to you, is the most complex form and the form which I think most people are most surprised at when they see it actually still happening in the streets of Philadelphia, and that's tap dancing. The Disco Queens and Kings have carried on the entire tradition of stepping, of soft shoe stepping, into their own repertoire. When they began to watch other dancers, they took GQ and Disco Tap one step beyond to look at other tap dancers and begin to incorporate actual tap dancing steps. Now, while you're putting on your shoes, could you explain a little bit about where you got tap moves from and why you added them to the repertoire of movements that you do?
Well, to be truthful, I know y'all remember Shirley Temple, Bo Jingles, who taught Shirley Temple, and Fred Astaire. We learned from watching them old-fashioned back in 1930 TV shows, way back there. We learned from really watching them TV shows every Saturdays, practicing off them, trying to learn more and more. But Divine, the real tap dancer, Levine, showed us the one-foot tap. And it's real hard to do because you got to keep your foot steady and let it roll. Show them one time. Let it be steady. The kind of tap dancing that we got off TV, I like to show you.
two. One, two, one, two.
Now the disco tapping is a little bit different because it's right along with the disco music. This is called disco tapping. Me and my brother like to show you together. Thank you very much.
I think at this point, there are many out there who might have questions for the Disco Queens and Kings on the dance moves or on their the whole tradition of dancing in the streets. Are there any questions for them at this point?
Hold up. Before you ask questions, I know y'all probably heard of kazoo before. It only costs 50 cents. We got this about 5 years ago as we was downtown. We brought it out the gallery. Listen to the sound of it. That's called a kazoo. We use this with our rhythm because it's something good to use instead of all them horns and stuff. This is something real good to use. Instead of buying you a $75 horn, this sounds a little better to me than a horn.
The other advantage, of course, is that the kazoo and the drums are easily movable. So that when you go downtown, you can pack it all on the bus if you have to, carry the drums with you, carry the kazoo, set up where you get out, set up wherever the police aren't going to hassle you. And they used to be around the clothespin in right near City Hall in Philadelphia. Police started hassling people there, so it's now a matter of getting a permit and choosing a storefront that will allow you to perform regularly in front of the storefront. But the kazoo, of course, something that you can carry and is quite handy. Now, questions. Are they going to dance? You've missed their last performance on the main stage.
We'll do a little bit for y'all. Y'all want to see a little bit? Okay. We'll do a little bit for y'all. Thank you very much. There's more to it than that, but we just can't do but so much.
Other questions?
Come on, ask us some questions. We like
them. Oh, come on now. Y'all didn't learn that much in the workshop. Yes, ma'am. Okay, how long have you been doing it? How many years? How old are you now? Right.
I'm 18 now. And my brother right here, 19. My little sister, 8 years old. She been dancing since she was 5, too. She 14. She started when she was around about 7. Paul right here, 14. He started when he was around about 10 or 12, something like that. We was real young.
It's real hard to do any demonstrations of breakdancing on this stage. We just did a head spin a little while ago.
We're going to just do the 1990. To be truthful, he the only one in Philadelphia got this.
Hey, tell them what 1990 is.
The 1990 is spinning on one hand. Well, instead, it's too small. We're going to do the elbow for y'all real quick. That's spinning on your elbow. Up in the air on your elbow. He the only one in Philadelphia really can do all this kind of stuff. Spinning on the elbow. We're really running up time right now.
So we'll have two more quick questions. One is right there.
The movie Breaking, all right, but before Breaking and all of that kind of stuff came out, we've been on corners doing lots of better things than the movies Breaking and stuff. Breakdancing don't really mean nothing to me because I'm a GQ dancer and I make Breaking look bad the way I dance for real and tap. It don't mean nothing to me. It's just a thing where you're hurting yourself, to be truthful.
One last question. Yes, sir.
It's practice. It's practice. A lot of practice, I guess. A lot. A lot.
A lot of breakdancers actually lift weights with their neck to build up their muscles so that they can do the head spins.
Breaking on your head without a hat, all it do is draw a bald spot in your middle of your head. Without a hat, it will definitely draw a bald spot. You got to get all that cut off.
Okay, let's have a big hand, please, for the Disco Queens and Kings.
Thank you very much,
too. This is their last stage appearance at the festival here.
God bless all y'all. Everybody say ho! And don't never forget to say Queens and Kings. God bless you all. Good luck with y'all.
Now come on down to Philadelphia on some weekend. Just hit downtown and you'll see them out there in the summer. Stage. Before Willie was a comic, he was a dancer. Again, working tent show stages, nightclubs, Broadway revues, and, of course, the Savoy Ballroom in New York City. What we're going to do today is talk about those traditions of entertainment. We'll talk for a little while about a few of the selected traditions, let's say carnival and minstrelsy, some aspects of dance, how he got to be a humorist, why we're doing this on the stage here. And then we'll open up the floor to questions from the audience about any of the traditions that we'll discuss. The best way to start is to simply say that when we're talking about traditions here at the festival, most people think of tradition passed from generation to generation, from father to son, from mother to daughter. The traditions we'll be talking about here on the stage are not traditions passed down in that way. Rather, they are traditions of the black stage, traditions passed not from father to son, but from older performer to younger performer. And it's that passage on the stage all the time, not on the street, not necessarily in other settings, not at house parties or places like that, but rather on the professional stage where traditions of comedy and traditions of dance are passed on so that jokes being told in a African-American-owned minstrel show in 1890 were still being told in 1940 in a black carnival show and are still being told in senior citizen centers and on the stage of the Folklife Festival here today. What was that, Willie? I know you aren't that old. So we'll start off by, Willie, could you tell us how you got your break into show business? Now, you started off in Georgia, didn't you?
That's right. Yeah, I was in Georgia. I say Augusta, Georgia. But when you hear me say Augusta, Georgia, I was 10 miles out of Augusta. I was on a farm. But that was the closest big town to me. And I used to come to town to see the carnival and the circuses. And I used to come, and when we get there, we wouldn't have money to go in. So we used to carry water. They'll open a fire plug then years ago, and we would take buckets of water for the animals. And then they would give us a pass to go on the show. So later on, I wanted to leave. I got about 10 years old. I wanted to leave. So I tried to leave with a carnival. They told me no, they wouldn't let me go. But when I got 13, I put my age up. And I left with a carnival. But I didn't work the carnival I was helping around the carnival, helping put up tents and running errands and doing things like that. I wasn't dancing on the stage or doing nothing on the stage. So I kept on with them until I got all the way to Washington. And I got to Washington, I had an aunt in Atlantic City. So I went over to my aunt's where she was. And she put me back in school. I stayed in school 1 year, and then I left and went to New York. Now, you know what I want to do for them? Today I'm going to give you an idea and what a carnival is like and how you make your money on a carnival.
Let me say a quick word about carnival shows. Okay. There's one thing, since we're going to talk about carnivals today, as of now, one thing I want to say about carnivals. You know, when we think of carnivals nowadays, how many people here think of performing shows at a carnival? There's a few hands out there.
Very few today. Yeah.
Very few. Most carnivals nowadays are what? They're rides.
Yeah, they know that.
They're games, right? Rides and games. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have a show, a freak show, something of that sort. See the bearded lady. See the woman turn into a boa constrictor.
Don't have them much.
Not much of that anymore. However, traditionally, back all the way into the 1800s and all the way up until fairly recent years. I know you're not that old, Willie. Okay. We already did that.
Bring it up a little.
Carnivals carried with them at least one tent, which specialized in performance. Now, in the white-owned and operated carnivals, which was almost all carnivals, especially in the early part of this century, there was always a tent which included black performers and only black performers. Willie, could you tell us a little bit about the nature of that tent? What was that called and why was it there?
Well, I'm going to tell them, but I want to give them some calls, how we get them in.
Okay.
What's the difference?
Do the whole thing there.
That's what I want to do. Give me yours. I want you. Oh, come on.
There you go.
Okay. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm getting ready to say, the show was called a plantation show. Some of it call it a minstrel show. It would call a jig show. It would call different things. And in that show, you would have singers, dancers. You would have a chorus girl. You would have a blues singers, tap dancers. You would have all that. And that was about an hour and a half show you would get. But the first thing on the carnival, before you could give a show, you had to tell the people what you were going to do. You would get outside and say, ladies and gentlemen, right down in close. We're going to bring them out and give you a little on the outside. We do a whole lot on the inside. Come on down, ladies and gentlemen. Come right down in close. Come on down in close. Yeah, just put one foot in front of the other and you'll be right down here. Yeah. Well, they done come down on each side. Now they leave a hole in the middle. I said, would you please cover up that hole? I said, before somebody would fall in and break the leg and you have to shoot them. Well, that was, you know, make them come down. Then I would say, a fellow back there, hey. I say, yeah, I know you don't want to go on this show. I know your mother told you not to go in there because my mother told me not to go in there. She said, if you go in that show, you'll see something you don't want to see. So one day I slipped in and she was telling me the truth. I saw something I didn't want to see. It was my father sitting on the front seat. Yeah, you would come down and then you say, you bring somebody out. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is the way you had to have that, because that's why he was telling you then that you would have to have this show for the family. See, because everybody didn't come to play games then, didn't come to ride. And they wouldn't let you bring a show in unless you bring a minstrel show with it. So you would tell them to come on in, and then you would give them a picture. Say, now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll bring out the girl. She's going to do a little dance for you. She'll come out and do a little dance. Say, now, she'll do more on the inside. And you say, this is a show for the ladies, gentlemen, and children. It's a family show. There will nothing be said, seen, or done to offend the most fastidious person among you. Then you bring a comedian out. Say, now, this is a man. If he don't make you laugh, he'll make you laugh at one side and down the other. If you don't laugh at him, go see your family doctor or something erratically wrong with your laughing apparatus. And then he will say, come on down. Then everybody get in. He said, now, get in line. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's nighttime. We had a matinee this afternoon, and we had matinee tickets, but they went off at 5 o'clock. It's not 7. So we're going to do something for just 3 minutes. All right, ticket sellers, put away your $3 tickets and take up the $1.50 tickets. They put them away. So now, ladies and gentlemen, if you fast enough and quick enough in the next 3 minutes. Don't come back and say the man said. Get in line. You can get in for half price. Your line, there's a ticket box here and a ticket box there. So you get in line. So long as you're in line. And you say, if you don't like the show, you come right back out to this ticket box and ask for your money back. Said, I'll come right back and ask for your money back. You won't get it back, but we'll have a hell of a time talking it over. And then that show go off. Now, later on, the carnival show was different from the minstrel show. The minstrel show would have a late concert. The carnival show, I know a lot of you have heard, a midnight ramble. Anybody ever heard of the midnight ramble? Well, that late show be the midnight ramble. You hear the bar come out and say, now, ladies and gentlemen, I know you've been in here all the week and see, but tonight is a midnight ramble. No children. You must be over the age of 18 and under the age of 80. The reason for that, if you're under the age of 18, you won't understand it. If you're over the age of 80, God knows you couldn't stand it. So then you'll say, well, now, ladies, now this time, we're going to bring Kitty from Kansas City out. The way she shakes it, it's a pity. That's that. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you can't stand nothing hot, just go on down the Midway and get you some popcorn and ride the mail, go around and go home and say you had a good time. This is for the broad-minded ladies and gentlemen. That time, ladies and gentlemen, this time we're going to bring Long Tall Sally doing a dance called Duck Back in the Alley. Whoa. You're going to bring her out. Now, no, she's not going to do the dance she did today. She pulled off a little here and a little here and a little yonder. Then you say, all right, now, this time, ladies and gentlemen, the last dancer we're going to bring out, she don't pull off anything. No, on the show, she don't pull off anything because she won't have nothing to pull off. But that's the ramble. Now, no children for that one. That's it. That's it.
That was a rare treat. That's the first time at the festival that we've heard some of the carnival front talk here. A word needs to be said about minstrel shows. Willie was talking about minstrel shows on a carnival. Now, when most people think of minstrel shows, at least when most who have never seen a minstrel show think of the minstrelsy, they think of a tradition that was developed by whites in the 1800s, where whites would don cork, would put burnt cork on their faces, and perform what were really caricatures of African-American music and dance and humor. When people talk about minstrelsy, more often than not, they think about these whites in blackface doing the mockery and the mimicry of African-American culture. What folks tend to forget is that in about, again, the 1880s, 1890s, African Americans themselves began to take black minstrel shows out on the road. They borrowed the same format, the same performance format in terms of starting off in a certain way, dividing the performance into three sections, some of the same comedy, some of the same styles of dance that were being done on the white-owned and operated minstrel shows. Except now the black-owned shows were employing only black performers and showing almost entirely to black audiences. So you had the development in the black minstrel show of an entirely new form of minstrelsy. It was this form of minstrelsy that was ultimately borrowed by the carnival shows, the plantation shows that Willie was talking about. Those shows took the large minstrel shows, which featured a band, a blues singer, some dancers, some comedians. It took parts of that show, compressed it, did small routines, short bits, a little bit of music, you didn't have as full of a band, and you'd put it on with the carnival. So when we talk about minstrelsy, we're not talking about white-faced minstrelsy at all, or black-faced minstrelsy done by whites, but rather we're talking about minstrelsy performed by blacks, largely to black audiences. Now, in the carnivals, clearly, unlike the minstrel shows, you were showing to mixed audiences. You weren't only working with a black audience because the carnival would move into a town and you'd deal with both black and white audiences. Willie,
yes.
What was done about that? Was there any, first of all, how did the carnival treat the entry of blacks and whites? Did they bring them into the same show? Was there a way of keeping them divided within the show?
Oh, yeah, they brought them into the same show. But the only thing would divide them, they would put a line right straight down the middle. The white on one side and the colored on the other. And I tell you what, if the white side got filled up and the color side was half open, they would be right over there. If the color side got filled up and the white side was open, they'd be over there. And everybody would sit together, no kind of argument. Get it? That's it. That's the only thing. That's a little rope dividing you.
A question that we often get on the stage when we discuss this has to do with the use of cork. Now, clearly, when the whites did minstrel shows, they were mocking black performance forms, and they were doing so by putting burnt cork on their faces and hands to darken their skin. In the black community, the performance tradition that extended, I guess, well into the 1940s probably, also called
to the early 50s, some of it.
Also called for the use of cork, though it was black performers showing at least on the minstrel stage to all black audiences, the cork was still used. Willie, could you talk a little bit about that? First, maybe why it was done, and then how it was that it came to change.
Well, I can't tell you exactly how it was done, but it was a tradition we saw other people do it. And when we started the show, we did that to start the show off. You know, start off by having our own show because it was owned by somebody else before. Uh-huh. And a lot of people don't know even that the white shows was white people. How many of here know that Amos and Andy was white?
This is the Amos and Andy radio team.
A lot of people didn't know it. Amos and Andy was white. The two black crows was white. But now, Amos and Andy show after television, they turned it back over to us because they couldn't show it on television like that. And they had so many squawks, they had made enough of money. They was millionaires, that's why. And they gave it back to us. But they had made their money marking us all the time. And a lot of people didn't know. I didn't know until last week that so many people didn't know that they was white. I thought everybody knew it was white. So many people told me, no, they didn't know it. They thought it was always colored, but they wasn't. So that's why we used to make up. I used to make up, put a big lip on and everything. And in the early 50s, the late 40s, they start to getting away from it. Nobody, you didn't have to. Why should you black up to be yourself? Didn't have to black up to be yourself. So I stopped blacking up. I still kept putting a big lip on to make my mouth wider. And I was waking with a lady, and she said to me, why you make your mouth wider? I told her, she said, your lip's big enough without that. So then I stopped. I didn't do that anymore. So that's as far as I can go. I really don't know.